This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The potential of machine learning is so big. And at Capital One, we're fighting fraud with random forests, giving mobile app outages the causal model anomaly detection treatment, and speeding up online shopping with machine learning at the edge. And that's just the start. I'm Eric Mueller, Senior Distinguished Machine Learning Engineer, and this is Machine Learning at Capital One. Capital One, what's in your wallet?
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
This podcast is presented by an Australian, by which I mean this episode contains strong language. It also contains some adult content. This is NB.
Non-binary.
Dismantling the gender binary.
One big question at a time.
I'm Caitlin, and I'm just figuring out my gender identity.
I'm Amru, and I've been out for a while.
Amru's going to share what they've learned.
And hopefully learn some new things too.
Okay, let's go.
This is part one.
Realizing. Today we are going on our first road trip to Brighton and to the Museum of Transology at the Brighton Museum and Art Gallery. Where are they? Hey, good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
Yeah, good. There's Amru. They're a writer, performer, and aquarium enthusiast who describes almost everything as iconic. They're my friend and my mentor. My friend-tor. They hate that. You look beautiful.
Thank
look at your
you.
Sparkly eyes.
I know, sorry, I did a show last night.
I should probably tell you a bit about who I am too. By day, I work for Radio 4 at the BBC. I book guests, I record interviews, and I generally do behind-the-scenes things to make sure radio happens. I moved to the UK from Australia in 2012 with my partner Roman, who you'll hear from later in the series. I am 29 and 1/12, but I like to tell people that I'm almost 30 in hopes it'll somehow mean that they take me more seriously.
We've got the most beautiful leftover sparkly eyeshadow.
Really had a time
it's the same colour as your nails, so that's good.
Oh, yeah, I just got these done.
They look great.
You'll notice I refer to Amru as them rather than he or she. If you've not met anyone who uses gender-neutral pronouns before, you'll get used to it. About 5 minutes into the first conversation I ever had with Amru, I knew I wanted to go through this process with them beside me. Coming out, making a podcast, they're kind of the same thing. Anyway, back to the road trip and the train to Brighton.
So we both identify as non-binary.
And you've really got your shit together,
do
I feel.
Do I?
Well.
Okay, externally on the surface, I think it seems like I have my shit together. The illusion is working. I'm so excited. I mean, I think I... But, you know, being non-binary for me is such a constant questioning of my gender and my sexuality and my worldview that I feel like, in a way, you can't really have your shit together as someone non-binary because you're constantly questioning and interrogating yourself. And I still have a lot of questions. You seem to have your shit together to me.
Oh, my God. I have so many questions. I have nothing together.
And it's because of those questions and the very long waiting list for therapy that I'm doing this podcast. This episode is about the very first stage of that, of coming out to yourself. The first time that you realise.
I think I've always been non-binary. I just didn't know I had tools in society to express it. I don't know about you.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me because I feel like even when I was a kid, maybe up to like the age of 11 or 12, that gender didn't factor into lots of my thinking as my sexuality kind of didn't either, because I was attracted to boys and girls, and because everyone at the age of 10 is basically just a blob of a human.
Yeah.
It was never really like a super important thing. And then all of these little external messages about gender that are so binary start like infiltrating their way into your mind. And I don't even think I clocked that I was femming up when I was in my early adolescence. And then dismantling all of that stuff over the last couple of years. Like, I think it all started because I got a haircut and I had short hair all of a sudden. And I remember having short hair when I was a kid and I was like, oh, and then this whole kind of thought process unravels from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I was raised between Dubai and Bahrain, and it was just a very gendered society. And the fact that there were just, you know, men's areas in the mosques and women's areas in the mosque, and, you know, men did this and women had these kind of jobs, it's really embedded in where I was from. So for me, I was just like, okay, because I have a penis, I guess I'm supposed to do these things that all boys do. And I've got a twin brother who's straight and cisgender. So that means, you know, he feels comfortable as a man. And
you're like a control group for each other.
I know. We are. I mean, if anyone wants to pay us to experiment on us, we will take your money and give you no information.
Being the person who is going on this journey and talking into a microphone is like a kind of non-binary experience in itself for me, because I'm so used to being the one operating the equipment, not the one talking into it. And the reason that I'm doing that, despite the fact that it is really uncomfortable for me in so many ways, is because I know that I need to like go through this process and essentially come up with not some lifelong answers, but some answers for now about what kind of person I am, and be able to articulate those things to the people in my life.
Have you come out to your family as non-binary, Caitlin?
I don't know. This is part of the podcast, and I am going to play the first few episodes to my parents.
Wow.
And then I'm going to have a conversation with my dad and kind of take it from there. I sort of did a really classic. My family, we really, really deeply love each other, and we know each other very well. It's a pretty comfortable, fairly progressive environment in my household, but we don't tend to like talk about things in great detail. We just assume everyone knows everything.
Right.
And like, my dad likes my Instagram posts, so like, he probably knows, but I haven't had the conversation yet. And I think that is part of going home this Christmas for me, is really going to be about making sure that I have those conversations and I'm really honest, because when you live, you know, 10,000 kilometers away from your parents, it's easy for them not to know you very well, even though you love each other really deeply.
But that stage, coming out to my family, is for later on. This episode is about coming out to myself, which is why we've come to the Museum of Transology, because it's somewhere that's meant a lot to me. The first time I went there, I just cried and cried. So, we head inside, where we meet the curator, EJ Scott.
Okay, here we are. I mean, this was so meaningful to me the first time. I just can't wait for you to see it.
Oh, wow. EJ, what's your pronoun?
Yeah,
he.
I
mean, he or they or my name, I don't care.
Okay.
EJ is 5'2" and dressed like a trendy lumberjack. He could be 30 or 50. He bounces on the balls of his feet and gives us the warmest welcome to the museum.
So we're on the other side of the door of the Museum of Transology, and there are like 20 kids in there.
Yep, they must all be, what, about 12 years old, maybe?
Yeah. Imagine having that at 12 years old, getting to look at this.
And they're all very loud and very excited and looking at everything very intently.
That's amazing, the idea of having this as a child.
And here they all come through now.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, everyone.
Did you enjoy the exhibition?
Yes.
Oh, yay.
That was a yes. They said yes.
That was lots and lots of yes.
Bye. God, imagine having that. I didn't even know anything about this until I was like,
that would they all seem so open-minded. And
well, I think exhibitions play a really important role in doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, coming to a museum, museums are places where you learn about life, where you learn about the world that you live in. It's a space that teaches you, you know, who you are in the scheme of things. It means that these kids that are already thinking about this stuff mm-hmm. have an opportunity to be true to themselves at a younger age, but it also means that people are starting to see themselves in the museum's collection mm-hmm. in a way that they haven't been included before.
The kids, they're going to, I mean, every generation thinks this, that the kids are doing much better than us, but oh, they really are.
Yeah, look, I think that ultimately, gender will be like getting a haircut. You know, it will be no big thing. You will go along, you'll go, that's the one I want today, thanks very much. You know, it comes in this size and this shape, and no one will even think about it, you know. I think we're just still really, really, we're making progress, but actually, I think we'll look back in 100 years' time and go, they were really old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, I hope so.
Do you want to come over here?
Yeah.
So over here in this cabinet is what I struggled with the most.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
These are my boobs in a jar.
So this
right?
is...
Those were your...
Yep, so that's me up there. And you can see my scar of my tattoo where it's been cut off there is what's left on my chest there. So
we've got two mason jars identical to the ones that I put my porridge in. And
yep.
within that, we've got EJ's breasts.
Yep.
One of them has 3/4 of a tattoo.
Exactly.
And the other quarter is...
It's
still...
It's a Hades.
And all of these letters. I mean, there's one... the one that really, really sticks in my head, I realise, was written to you. Dear Mr. Scott, this has got an NHS masthead on it. Further to earlier discussions, I understand that you wish to retain your breast tissue following its removal at your procedure today. I have discussed this extensively with our consultant histopathologist.
Yep.
Essentially, your breasts will be dealt with in the normal way whilst in the operating theatre and will then be sent to histopathology. If the breasts are to be actually left intact for yourself, then the histopathologist will be unable to make any histological examination of them. The breasts will require some 2 weeks to become fully infiltrated by the formalin, which...
Formaldehyde, yeah.
My suggestion, therefore, would be that you collect your breasts from the histopathology department at the Royal Sussex County Hospital in Brighton on the same day that you see me for your post-operative visit. This will allow sufficient time for the breast to become infiltrated, as stated earlier. I mean, that's a medical letter, and yet it's also like some collaborative art project. That is so cool.
That is so cool.
And you can just imagine. And do you know what? I was too busy to actually go up to collect them, so my partner went up, and, you know, there she goes wandering down the street with 2 buckets of boob in each one. Trying not to spill the contents. What did you do today, dear? I just picked up your boobs. Thanks for that.
And where did you keep them?
In my cupboard for a very, very long time.
Next to what other things?
Yeah,
next to the porridge? How do you feel as someone involved in arts that you are kind of letting everything that is like hyper, hyper personal to you become like your work? How complicated is that?
I am a curator. I am a museum person. My whole life doesn't revolve around being a trans curator. That informed my understanding of why it was really important to do an exhibition like this and build a collection. But at the same time, it's not... Well, you don't, as a curator, curate something that's autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
And so this complicated the two and became almost half art exhibition, half museum exhibition. So I've got over 250 objects here that, you know, the majority of them came through meetings that I ran in consultation with the community, through workshops, or through people posting things to my house. And I would literally come home and there'd be something through my letterbox door and I'd be like, okay, what's this one going to be? What's it going to talk about?
But there's also a lot of positivity in the exhibition. There's a lot of taking up space and people just saying, you know, I am here, this is what I look like.
This feels really concrete. And there's something celebratory in that, even though, I mean, most of the time I've spent in here previously, I have been sobbing openly, you know.
If we come over here, it's a cabinet that's full of hormones.
Mm.
And it's a really good example to me of why this exhibition had to be made by the community, because all of these boxes are largely the same. You know, there's multiple boxes that are exactly the same,
right?
But in actual fact, every single story's different. So one of them says, this made me the dad that I always wanted to be. You know, another one says, I had a really hard time fighting with the health services to get access to the treatment that I wanted. Another one talks about coming out to their mum, right? So it's actually the multiplicity of voices that debunks these myths that all trans people go through the same thing. All trans people transition. All trans people have a before and after. All trans people are binary, right? So it takes all those myths away, because it's the community that is telling you what non-binary means.
Yeah.
It's the community that's telling you what trans means.
All these boxes, and behind every single one is a different story, a different person. And that's the point.
It feels really non-hierarchical in here. Like, it feels like there's no singular object that has, like, pride of place. It feels almost like a living room worth of loads and loads of objects, which I think makes it so much more human and just lets people understand that it's just real lives.
And that's why this space is so incredible and so important. And that's why I wanted to start here, because this is what I want this podcast to be, essentially. I want it to be a big collage of experience and in a space where we get to center ourselves. That's what's so significant.
This is really interesting to me as well. How do you identify? What language do you use for yourself?
This is one of the first times I've ever been asked this question, and I don't have an answer prepared.
I say non-binary, and I sometimes say gender fluid.
At this point, I'd literally never called myself gender fluid before in my life. I was just trying it out.
And I use they, and that's tricky because it feels like a transitional in and of itself, and it's hard to like get your head around the idea that that is just going to be like a constant kind of hinterland that you're in.
I would use the language genderqueer. I'm older than you, right? And that's certainly the language that I use, that I think I see increasingly replaced by the term non-binary.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was coming out, when I was young as queer, the older LGBT people would say that that's possibly not a word that they would have used, but that I found very empowering. I kind of feel like I am now that granddad myself, looking at non-binary people, because I don't like the term non-binary. I find it really problematic that people are starting their description of their gender freedom with a negative. I find
really
it difficult that they are also defining themselves as not being normative. So in a way, the term non-binary reinforces that there is a binary, and I don't think it gives creative and spiritual freedom, enough freedom, to people that are actually in this incredibly vast space that is the breadth of the spectrum, you know, at their fingertips. And I said, nope, I'm not a binary, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel, I see what you're saying. There's something about non-binary that works for me in that I just feel absolved somehow. I don't know.
Yeah.
If you feel, I feel like I'm not part of the binary. Great. I'm rejecting you. You're not rejecting me. If you see what I'm saying, I'm going, this system's not good for me.
Yeah, and it is actually like actively removing yourself from something, which I definitely identify with as well. But I think for me, like, I feel that I've grasped for a word that other people who are like me are already using.
Quite right.
And that's like sort of useful enough to be getting on with.
Quite right. And it's the last thing that I really, you know, necessarily need to critique.
Yeah.
It's just something
that
really fast shifting language, you know, that helps shape our experiences, because it's what we use to label and identify ourselves and each other.
Can we walk over to my favourite bit?
Yep.
You know, apart from the breasts, which, you know, really, really stayed with me, I've got to say. Those are great. And this is this tree of little responses from people.
This is the opportunity for people to write their own tags as if they're part of the exhibition, and encouraging people to explain their own gender experiences. And honestly, we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of them. So that one says, be yourself. This one says, for Millie, I am not a he, I am not a she, I am me.
Here's something in kanji, so I can't even read that. This one just says fluid.
Yeah, they're incredible.
I just keep thinking, what courage. So it's not all people reflecting on themselves. I think the one that I remember from the previous time I was here was a parent talking about their child, and they said, I'm so proud of my son. And I just...
Yeah.
It's just...
There's so many beautiful stories, and that's what warms my heart, and that's what kept me going throughout the whole project, you know, is that just when you thought, you know, it was going to be a real downer, something magical will happen.
Victoria.
How did you feel today meeting EJ and being in that space?
In the kind of few months since I was last there, so much has changed for me. I'm like so much more comfortable, like to the point where I'm actually like making this podcast, for example. But going into that space again and feeling like I was part of it, like I was allowed to take up space rather than feeling like maybe I'm a visitor, and actually, yeah, I've crossed some sort of line into going, this is a we and an us, and I feel part of that community now.
Well, you're going to be meeting my best friend now, Victoria Sin.
Should I tell you what I had for breakfast?
Yeah, please.
So this morning I had some bran flakes and some sweet and soy milk, and after...
They are an AFAB, so that means assigned female at birth. Non-binary drag performer. They started creating a lot of spaces for queer people of colour like me and trans and intersex people of colour to share our stories and just feel safe. Yeah, I actually have them tattooed on my leg. It's on my thigh, staring up at my genitals, just keeping them safe.
Victoria Sin is exactly the sort of person I wish I'd known when I started this process. They're wearing the crispest shirt I've ever seen and working out of an incredibly chic art studio with white walls and exposed brickwork. As we walk down the stairs to the studio we'll record in, Victoria asks for my pronouns. It's still a thrill to say they.
Congratulations on coming out.
Thank you.
It's really special.
Yeah, thanks. It's overwhelming, but like in a mostly nice way. And basically, I know that for Amru, you've like been really important in their process as well. So like,
that
I thought
true.
Amru's been important in my process. Yeah.
So I called Victoria. I was like, I came out to just a group of people, and it was not fun. Mm. I was like, but Victoria was like, if you are feeling gender dysphoria, you are allowed to use whatever words you need to yeah. help with that. And then yeah. I decided to just go for it.
Also, it's not something that's like, you know, that should be like you're making this huge decision. It's like, it should be like, you know, like this year I feel like a they, and if next year I feel like a she, then that's not mm-hmm. anything to be ashamed of. Yeah. Like to be able to like play with your gender and try some things on and have people take you seriously shouldn't be like this crazy ask.
I don't have that many relationships with like other queer people in my life. Mm. And it must feel like an incredible kind of comfort to be able to like sense check some of the things that you're feeling with someone who might have some more stuff in common with you. Like,
yeah.
And the process of realizing that you are non-binary is so internal and so gradual, as you say, because like, I think, you know, you think, oh, maybe I knew when I was a child and then maybe I knew again as a teenager and maybe I knew in my 20s, you know, how far back do all of those feelings go for both of you?
I think like the more that I dig, the more that I feel like I can see it, like in my youth. I remember thinking like, I've been a femme AFAB person for a long time, and like when did this dysphoria come? Like when did I decide I would stop like wearing makeup every day? And then I was looking at some like pictures of myself when I was a kid, and I completely forgot that like from the age where I could kind of choose my own clothes until like middle school, where like bullying really set in. I had like short hair and like was like wore like boys' clothes.
Really?
Yeah. And then middle school happened.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened to me as well. Like exact same time as well.
Talking to Victoria is so resonant. It's completely different. Non-binary people come from a lot of different positions, and not everyone is going to relate to everything every other non-binary person says. There's a lot that Amru and I don't have in common because of the genders we were raised as.
All I remember about the Middle East is women. I was there till I was 11. All I remember was I was so obsessed with my mother that we'd had this game where she would come home from work, and this sounds weird, but it wasn't as sort as it sounds, and I would just rub her thighs just so I could be close. And once when my mum was being a bit evasive with me because I think she was worried that like I wasn't hanging out with boys and she was just trying to, I incinerated my hand on a burner so she could take care of me for a week. I mean, that is the Middle East for me. It was like, and I think that was dysphoria. And then I moved to the UK, and then A, the war in Iraq happened, and I'm Iraqi, in 2003, that was I was 13. So that made me quite dysphoric from my race. So I was like, yeah, I guess I'm kind of white now. Because I just knew goodies were the UK, baddie was like my country, so, and I want to belong here.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, my parents were so like, you cannot be gay, you cannot be anything. So I tried to mask up hilarious. What was the process for you?
It was like a long process for me. And I think I thought about it for a really long time before I, like, you know, the first step was like changing my pronouns to they on Facebook. And I didn't tell anybody. I was just like, that was just like my little, like, you know, that, yeah, to just see how it felt. I think the more that I did it the first few times I asked people to start using non-binary pronouns for me, the more right it felt. And then suddenly when people used like she pronouns for me, it started feeling like really like, ooh, like I really don't like that. It kind of, yeah, dysphoria is the word for it. But I had the same experience. I remember the first time I told somebody that I was like, I think I'm non-binary. And they said something like, he said something like, you know, I think that basically saying that like I was just doing it to get attention.
That's like, so consistent in this narrative, isn't it? That makes me really, really mad. Mm. Because I think like, why would you put yourself through that if you weren't feeling really properly uncomfortable?
It, like, I think that after like coming out as non-binary, like my life has started to change. My attitudes have started to change. My like sex life has started to change because I can perceive myself in like different ways that I felt like shameful about before. Mm, you know, like, yeah. I feel like coming out as non-binary was like part of a process of like taking like a, you know, like something off of my eyes to like be able to start to see things clearly. And now it's just like this huge chest of things that I'm just trying to like constantly every day unpacking, and constantly every day I'm like learning new things about myself and also the world, you know.
It's so exciting to hear that as like someone on the start of this journey. I am looking forward to opening my chest a bit more. That sounded so dumb.
Dignity. Always dignity. But what Victoria's saying about how much has changed for them since coming out as non-binary is exactly what I'm excited about for myself. So, once you've realised that you're not a woman or you're not a man, what next? I'm not totally sure yet. But there are heaps more conversations to come in this series. This is just the start.
You've been listening to NB, presented by them, Caitlin Benedict.
And them, Amru Alkadi.
You can find us both on Twitter. Caitlin is at Caitlin Benny.
And Amru is at Glamru.
NB was produced by Arlie Adlington, Caitlin Benedict and Georgia Cat.
The editor was Alice Feinstein.
It was a BBC Radio Arts production for BBC Sounds.
Subscribe to NB, the best podcast on BBC Sounds.
There are other podcasts on there too.
But this is the best one.
Hello there, I hope you're enjoying this podcast, and if you are, then please check out the Hurricane Tapes on BBC Sounds. It's the story of Reuben Hurricane Carter, the famous boxer convicted twice of a triple murder in the 1960s.
Sometimes I feel like talking, and I have something that I want to say to you.
50 years later, this is the story of the hurricane.
Did he do it? Did he not? Through 40 hours of unheard tapes he recorded before he died, we try and find out. The Hurricane Tapes, available now on BBC Sounds.